Please join me in the Serenity Prayer. God,
I grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference.
Tonight, our 40-minute speaker is John W. from Santa Rancho. So Rancho Santa, don't drink margarita. I don't know.
I'm John. I'm an alcoholic.
There's
a lot of you fuckers here. My sobriety date is May 26th of 2000, and I'm very grateful for that. I'd like to start off by saying what I do now to stay sober. I have a sponsor. His name is Joe T. And I attend mostly men's meetings. I pray in the morning. I pray at night. Three times during the day, I religiously take part in the 11th step. I sponsor people. I've been involved with H&I. I take commitments. I speak even when I'm nervous as hell and terrified. And I make the spiritual concepts of Alcoholics Anonymous the cornerstone of my life. I'd like to tell you why I do these things. Because it wasn't by choice. When I was about 15 years old, I discovered something called alcohol. And I found a solution for what my ailment was. I found a lubricant, and I found a method, a device that allowed me to get along with all of you. I found a solution for alcoholism. I believe that my problems start when I put down the bottle. And, prior to finding alcohol when I was 15 years old, I always had to lie about everything constantly to fit in with everyone else because I just never felt that I was good enough. And this goes back to when I was like 4 or 5 years old. I just never felt good enough to be a part of anything. And my lying started when I was like 3 or 4 years old. I remember I was in preschool, and this was like the first big lie where I got caught in, and everyone laughed at me. And like a 101 Dalmatians movie came out, something like that, and all the kids at the preschool were talking about how awesome this new Disney flick was, and I'm like trying to join in with them. I'm like, yeah, the movie was awesome, and they're like, you never saw that, And I'm like, oh yeah, and everyone laughed at me, and this was before I even came into my own, my own consciousness, like right off the bat, I have no reason to be uneasy with life at 3, yet here I am lying to everyone and everything, 5 and 6 years old, you could find me standing in front of our next door neighbor's house throwing rocks through his windows because it seemed like a good idea. I get home, the next door neighbor would come out, drag me to the house, and my mom, my dad would punish me, and they're like, why did you do that? I don't know. I have no idea why I did it. And they hated that answer, and they let me know it. And it stayed that way until I found alcohol. I remember I'm in the 3rd grade, this was early 90s, something like that, and DARE came into our school. And, in the mid to late 80s and the 90s, things like that, there was all these anti-drug commercials, and DARE was huge in every school. And, they used to show this commercial, which was like this fried egg, and it's like, this is your brain. This is your brain on drugs. Any questions? And I'm like, yeah, how do I get mine to do that? That looks awesome. And I'm like 5 or 6, 7 at the time, there was another one where they had like, what was it? It's like, no one ever said I wanted to be a junkie when I grow up. And there's like this dude running away from the cops, and you see the cop's hand reach out to grab him. And every single time I saw that commercial, I'm like rooting that this time he gets away from that cop. And I'm 7, you know. Dare comes into my school, 3rd grade. And, you know, they're trying their scare tactics. They're telling us that this person thought, you know, that he was Peter Pan and he could fly. And he jumped off the roof of this building after smoking PCP. And I don't hear that he died. You know, I don't hear the negative. All I hear is, if you smoke PCP, you will fly. You know, I don't think circumstances really have much to do with my alcoholism. You know, I honestly just believe that I was born just a little tweaked, you know. And, like I said, up until 15, it was simply just, I had to do anything to get myself out of myself to feel okay, you know. And before I found alcohol, it was, you know, vandalism. It was throwing rocks, you know, through neighbors' windows. It was throwing bikes at cars that were driving down the street. Life became so much easier when I got drunk for the first time. You know, I didn't have to lie as much. Key word being as much. You know, we talk about the promises. We read them at every meeting. We will know a new freedom. We will know a new happiness. We will know peace. I found these things with alcohol, and I found these things with other substances that we'll call alcohol. For about 6 months, it worked. Every time that I got drunk, I got drunk, and I felt great. And, you know, I loved it. I literally felt like this was the thing that my life was missing. And, you know, it really was. And I decided very, very early on, like the first time I got drunk, that I'm going to do this every day for the rest of my life until I go to prison or die. Which I think is just a beautiful train of thought for a 15-year-old, you know, who just got drunk for the first time. I'm going to do this till I die. And I set out to do that. Very early on, I started getting consequences to my drinking. And, you know, my parents didn't know that I was alcoholic. I didn't know that I was alcoholic. I was adopted into a family where the largest secret in the family tree was my uncle wanted to go into the military, and my grandfather said he'd break his legs if he went. You know, I was adopted into a family that was just wholesome Midwestern Catholics. You know, and they just had no idea what to do with me, you know. And this was, you know, it was untreated alcoholism what this was. So they sent me to a boarding school. And this boarding school gave out 2 sets of brochures, depending on, you know, who they were marketing to. The first brochure that they sent out was to me and only one other kid that went to this school. You know, it's pretty much, okay, so your son, you know, or daughter, your kid's got bad grades, send them to us, we'll get him back on the right track. For like the 48 other people that went to the school, they got a different brochure, and it said, okay, so your 14-year-old just got out of prison. Send them to us. We'll get them back on the right track. So I learned how to drink from some real pros very, very early on, which was kind of cool, you know, because it meant that I'm not wasting any time. I learned the tricks of the trade very quickly. I'm a great manipulator. I don't know if there's any others, you know, in here that, you know, can just say the right thing at the right moment and get exactly what you want whenever you want. And that was me. And I didn't make any bones about my drinking. I was very open and upfront with the fact that this is a God-given right, and damn it, I'm going to drink, and there's nothing that you can do to stop me. And the school didn't like that very much. I'd always get busted on breathalyzers, things like that, or come up dirty on drug tests. And the way that this boarding school punished was, if you got in trouble, regardless what the offense was, they put you in a chain gang, and this was in Tucson, so it's like 115, you know, during the winter. They put you in a chain gang, they give you a shovel, and you literally just dig a hole for 5-6 hours, and then you sit in detention for 4 hours. I realized that if I was going to do this, I couldn't drink. That just ain't happening, you know. So my parents had just gone through a divorce at the time, and like I said, that has nothing to do with me being an alcoholic. But I was able to use that key fact to manipulate the people at the school. So I never had to do any punishment for, doing what it was that I was doing. And all the rest of the kids at the school are just like, who is this guy? You know, like, what makes him so special? So since the administration wasn't going to punish me, the people at this, my peers at the school decided that they were going to take matters into their own hands. And, they sneak into my room. The entire population of the school was like 50 kids, something like that. And probably 30 of them came into my room with baseball bats and whatever else they had lying around while I was sleeping and just beat the shit out of me. And I think anyone that is not an alcoholic, if that happened to them once, to any degree, would be like, you know what, maybe I just need to mellow out, at least while I'm here, and just do what everyone else wants me to do, because everybody hates me. I use it as an excuse to drink more, because now I'm also a victim. They kept trying to teach me the lesson over and over and over again. It was Tucson, so they throw rattlesnakes in my bed. They tie me to cactuses. And, this is the price that I'm simply willing to pay for getting drunk. Because when I drink, I feel awesome. I don't have problems anymore. And if it means having to spend an hour picking needles out of my back, it's all good. I'm going to pay this price, over and over and over again. I only drank for 3 years. Started drinking when I was 15 and a half, and I got sober at 18 and a half. Alcoholism in my case was very, very progressive because, like I said, I did a lot of other forms of alcohol that you didn't necessarily drink. And it got me into these rooms rather quickly. My first introduction to the 12 steps was in Tempe, Arizona at this school / rehab / I don't know what it was, 12-step program called Pathways. And essentially what it was is the lead guitarist of Styx got a resentment at some local AA meetings that he went to and he started his own program. How many great meetings have started just off of that, he wanted a place where young people could get sober and experience joy and sobriety. So my first experience is, this resentment-based treatment program, and it's just this huge warehouse in Tempe, and I walk in, and there's all these 14, 15, 16-year-olds. They're smoking cigarettes, and they're drinking terrible coffee, and they're listening to the same Bon Jovi song over and over and over again. And I'm in hell. I stay there for an hour or whatever, and I make fun of everybody, and, I realize that this probably won't be that bad since, I'm court-ordered that, next time I come here, I'll just be drunk. And, then I may actually be able to enjoy this AA thing. And that's what I did. That Bon Jovi song didn't seem as bad if I came drunk. And, I started picking up on some key words. They talked about, spirituality, and they talked about God. And that was a key word that I wanted absolutely nothing to do with. I hated God. Absolutely hated God. Couldn't tell you why. I just knew that somehow it was his fault. They talked about getting a sponsor. And I decided that could be okay. I can get a sponsor. because then I can just drink, and if everyone knows that I have a sponsor, I wouldn't possibly be drinking. So I picked the guy that looked the most like Charles Manson and asked him to be my sponsor, which actually turned out to be a terrible thing, because out of everyone that was there, he actually had the most time sobriety and was actually working steps. So we talk, and he just give me that look and smile and laugh, and I'd be drunk, and it was all good. I ran through friends very, very quickly. After that boarding school experience, I went back to a public school. And within the first couple weeks, I'm drinking with people that, were doing their homework during the week. They're drinking at parties on the weekends. And then they just go back to school. And, my weekend started going into Monday. And then my weekend started going into Tuesday. And everyone that, was just partying on the weekends is looking at me like I'm a freak. And since I don't like to be judged, I need to find people that are freaks like me. Started hanging out with people that are partying 4 days a week instead of just two. And, they start giving me that look. So I find people that, are partying just every day, all day, and have no ambitions. And, that works for me, I was 16 years old, gotten kicked out of my house, and I had my first experience living in a crack house. Lived there for a summer, and it was the best summer of my life, very, very progressive. 9 months before, I'm hanging out with people that are doing their homework, attempting to go to school, to, people who, had just stabbed people in the neck at their school like 2 weeks before, on the run from cops. And one of my favorite individuals that I ever met was this guy named Bob. Bob was probably 50, 55, something like that. I was 16 at the time. When I first met him, he came down the stairs, and he had this huge cast on his leg, and he was a carpenter. And apparently, he got in a work-related accident, and I think it happened like 10 or 15 years ago, but he was just so spun that just never bothered to take it off. So that was the first thing I noticed about... No, that was the second thing I noticed about Bob. The first thing I noticed about Bob is that he was wearing a dress. which, hey, some people like to do that. I'm not going to judge, But I was 16, so this was my first experience with someone wearing a dress. He was raised by Nazis who fought in World War II, and he had that mentality. And he liked to smoke crack. Really, really loved it. And this was my homie, for like the next 6 months. It was me and Bob. And I only smoked crack once, and it was never with him. It was with my sponsor, which we'll figure that one out. Not the sponsor I have now. One of the ones that I used to get people off my back. And Bob sat me down after the summer to give me a talk that maybe I need to look at my life and where it's going. And maybe I should go home. And maybe I should just calm down. And I got kicked out of my first crack house when I was 16. And I'm kind of like, okay, where do I go from here? I pretty much ran through everybody, so I decided to take my first geographic. That's going to solve everything. And, it's my stepmother that's the problem. It's my dad that's the problem. It's, the Phoenix Police Department, which are the problem. They are a huge problem, but they're not my problem. Like a good alcoholic, I decided to go to Kentucky. And on the plane ride to Kentucky, I make this little vow with myself where I'm not gonna quit drinking. I'm not gonna quit doing graffiti. I'm not gonna quit getting into fights. I'm not gonna quit doing anything that I'm doing. I'm just gonna mellow out on it. I'm not gonna do graffiti as much. I'm not gonna drink as much. I'm going to attempt to go to class. And 10 minutes later, I'm getting high in the airplane bathroom. That's alcoholism, you know. Even when I'm in my disease, I can still reach amazing new heights and levels that I did not know were possible. And the only thing I have to do is show a little backbone, you know, and my alcoholism will tell me that it has other plans for me. 2 weeks later, a lot of detectives come into the high school that I was at. They arrest me because they'd never seen such a huge graffiti outbreak in the city that I was living in. And I'm shocked, wondering how they knew it was me. You know, it's Kentucky. It's not like it gets a lot of tourism or visitors, you know. I'm the only new person that's been in the town in the last 2 weeks. And so for the next year, this starts a cycle for me. And the cycle was pretty much this. Go to inpatient rehab. I get out, celebrate by getting drunk. I would have a drug test the next day. I'd fail it. I go to jail. I get out of jail. I go to rehab. I get out of that rehab. I get drunk to celebrate. I have a drug test. I go to jail. That was the next year of my life. There was one treatment center that I went to. I was 17 at this time, and they told me that they would not let me leave until I finished the fifth step. And the rest of them were kind of like, you stay in there for 30 days, and then you come out, and you know, whatever, you do your thing again. I've been in there 90 days, and I kind of realized that they're not going to let me out until I finish this fifth step. So, you know, I write all the things through these Hazleton packets that, you know, the people wanted to hear on the first three steps. And I cannot tell you for the life of me why I did this, but I took that four steps very, very seriously. I had no intentions of being sober, but I saw that four step held some power. And I was brutally honest through that packet that they gave me. The packet that they gave me was not as it's outlined in the first 164 pages of the big book. So my part never really came into it. It was simply just a list of all the terrible things, or what I thought terrible things that I had done. And I worked the fifth step with the person that they made everyone work the fifth step with. And after that, I literally felt this huge weight just taken off of my shoulders. I felt free for the first time in my life, and I felt free without alcohol. And I had my first spiritual experience. I was 17. And it was awesome. It gave me the same reward that drinking gave me, with a lot less consequences, which was kind of cool. So I decided I'm going to try the sobriety thing. But I'm not going to get a sponsor, and I'm not going to work steps, and I'm not going to go to meetings. But I'm going to try the sobriety thing and see where it takes me. You know, I get out, and the first thing I do is I go meet up with all the people that also drink in the same spot that I used to drink at. And, you know, I give them the good news that I'm 95 days sober, and they said, "Oh, my God, that's fucking awesome. You want to get high?" And I'm like, "Yeah, of course I do." I said these words before I could even, you know, stop to think about the fact. I mean, I did want to go drink right then and there, but, you know, you would think 90 days off of it, you know, problem solved. But the reason that I said yes without even thinking about it is because I had no spiritual defense against that first drink. And I kind of store that in the back of my head for later. You know, at this point, once I put something in me, there's that saying, what is it, a head full of AA and a belly full of beer don't mix. You know, when I put beer in me, it's just fuck it. That's it. Anything that I was thinking before that is gone. You know, there was no feeling of guilt or, oh, I just relapsed or anything like that. It's just, I need more of this. This is a good thing. So that night I got arrested again and the process started over. You know, by this time I was on a court card and every single rehab that I went to was taking me to AA meetings and, you know, I'm here and keep coming back. It works if you work it. Get a sponsor. God, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, I hate all of you so much. Because there wasn't a reason for me to get sober yet. I drank, I got drunk, and I felt awesome. Why do I need to search elsewhere for a solution that I already have, you know? It wasn't until the thought of drinking became more scary than the thought of working a step that I decided to actually do something to change my life. Like I said, you know, I'd been around AA long enough to steal all your seven traditions, you know, con you out of money, have my drug dealers meet me in AA meetings, you know, typical alcoholic behavior, because I'm not ready yet. Now flash forward to, you know, the last 6 months before I got sober. I'll walk you through a typical day at the end. I've been homeless for about a year. And I was living in Phoenix again because although Phoenix was my problem, Kentucky was more of my problem than Phoenix was. And the alcohol that an 18-year-old can get in Phoenix is a lot better and cheaper. So I decided to become a cross-country drug dealer. You know, I'm going to go back to Phoenix for a bit. I'm going to buy, you know, everything that, you know, I could afford and take it back to Kentucky, sell it, and I'm just going to be balling. And I'm going to do this on the Greyhound. You know, I was going places. You know, even my dumbest ambitions disappear as soon as I get drunk, you know. By the time I got off that Greyhound, I'd only managed to drink once in the week. I get out of the Greyhound, my friend picks me up, I drink, the shakes go away, and I, ambition gone. Here I am, I'm staying. I'm staying in a road, behind like this road sign. It's kind of like this little makeshift wall that like welcomed you into the city. Been sleeping there for a couple months and I black out one night and I get woken up in the morning by three cops. Of course, they all know me by name and I know them by name. When I get woken up, I notice that I'm blind. I literally cannot see anything. And I'm just like, okay, John, you knew this day was coming. You smoked yourself retarded. You know? And as soon as the initial shock went away, it's like, oh, well, the price that I'm willing to pay, you know, and I believe that. And I'm having this conversation with the cops and, you know, they're asking me what I'm doing sleeping behind this sign. And I tell them, well, you know, what's it look like, you know? Apparently I had not gone blind. I had just passed out on a tube of toothpaste the night before. So my entire face is just covered in Colgate and all down my side. And when you're in that drunken, you know, woken up by the cops in the morning thing, like, I'm not going to feel my face. It's just like, okay, I'm blind now. This is what's happening. And this was like 7:45. And I was 18 at the time, so I should have been just about to graduate from high school. So all my friends are driving past me and the cops. They're honking and they're like, what's up, John? I'm just like, oh, my God. Hey. You know, covered in toothpaste. Cops take all my alcohol. They take all my pot. And this made me absolutely furious. They tell me that I can't be sleeping behind this road sign anymore. I need to find somewhere else to stay. And I told him there's this guy's backyard that he won't know that I'm going to be there. I could probably sleep there. And the cop's like, all right, it gets you off the streets. You know, so essentially this cop helps me break and enter in this guy's house. You know, he like throws all my shit behind the wall. And the guy wasn't too bright. Like, I'm doing all this while he's leaving for work in the morning. And, you know, I hop his wall, and as soon as I see his car pull away, I steal everything in his house. I don't have any alcohol. And it's like 8 o'clock in the morning. And I'm terrified. So I go back to the Circle K directly, like literally 50 feet away from where I almost had just gotten arrested. And I grab a bottle of champagne. I go in the bathroom. I chug it down. I come back out. All the cops that had just almost arrested me are in that Circle K. And I'm just like, oh, shit. At least I'm drunk. It means jail's not going to suck for 6 hours. And, you know, they tell me I'm looking a lot better. And I'm just like, oh, God, they know. They know. And they were just referring to the fact that, you know, I cleaned the toothpaste off of me and all that. And, you know, they're like, well, see ya. And that totally killed my buzz. So I had to steal another, you know, I had to steal another bottle of champagne, and I go back into the bathroom and I down it. And, you know, on my way out, I grab another one because two's never enough. You know, what's 80 ounces of champagne at 8 in the morning? It's a good start, but, you know, we need to get this thing really cracking. Like a sophisticated homeless gentleman that I am, I go back to their dumpsters and start drinking civilized. And I find a shirt in there that in the dumpster that was a little less dirty than the one that I had on, and I called it a damn good day. And you know, at this point, you know, I'm good. I'm where I need to be. So I go back to this guy's house and I start making all those drunken calls to people that I haven't talked to in like 5 years to let them know that, yes, I am drunk and life is awesome. It's like 8:45 in the morning. And this guy lived on a lake and he had a boat. And I realized in my drunken stupor that, you know, I need a boat, you know. Oh, yeah. 9 o'clock in the morning, I steal this guy's boat. Which really cracks me up. You know, I live in South Phoenix and I still manage to steal a guy's boat. That was a typical day for me. At the end, I was looking at 35 years in prison. I weighed 119 pounds. I'm 6'3", so there was not a lot to me. Everyone had the problem but me. And that was that. I was looking at a lot of time, but alcohol still worked for me. You know, so why am I going to change anything? But looking at that much time made me realize that, okay, Phoenix really is my problem, and I need to get the hell out of here. So I have two escape routes. I tell my mom that I want to be sober, which I don't want to be, you know, and I'm ready to change my ways, and I need help. And I told another friend of mine, you know, I need to go to California. I don't care where I go. And she says, yeah, in 2 weeks, I'm hopping on a train. I'm going to go work at this pot farm in Humboldt. The only reason I chose sobriety is because the plane ticket was literally like 2 days earlier than the train ticket. I had no intentions of being sober. I get to this treatment center, it's in Laguna Beach, and, you know, they promised me that they'd have a ride waiting for me at the airport and, you know, all this stuff, and I'm in LA and there's no ride, and, there was no case managers there. I never saw a counselor. They never gave me a big book. They tried to take us to one meeting a week, and it was just not for me. And I couldn't get drunk, and I couldn't get high. And there was this 2-week period where I call it just being stuck between solutions. Everyone that was getting high at the rehab told me that I had messed my life up too much and they're not going to get me drunk. And I wasn't old enough to buy liquor. And there's no damn way that I'm going to work steps because God sucks. I had 2 weeks of living in my own skin. And that was more terrifying than facing prison. That was more terrifying, you know, than anything that I'd ever been through in my life. And I knew something had to change. There was this guy that everyone called affectionately Jungle Boy in the rehab. And when I say affectionately, I mean everybody hated his guts. He would cuss out everybody. He would start fights with everybody. He did nothing but lie constantly. The oldest woman that was in the rehab, just the most disgusting things would come out of his mouth that he would say to her. And I hated this guy with every bit of my fiber, you know, with just every bit of my being. I hated him. And I knew that I was going to kill this guy. And as soon as I, you know, realize that I'm going to kill this guy, this euphoria just washes over me. And I'm at peace with the fact that I'm about to become a murderer. I'm like, shit, I didn't know it was this easy. And that terrified me. And it made me realize that the reason that I hate him so much is because he's me. You know? I was saying all the exact same things to everybody in there. I was picking fights with everybody. There's no way I could ever tell the truth. And the reason I hated him so much is because it was looking in the mirror. And he was better at what he did than I did. And that's also why I hated him, because I wasn't the worst anymore. But I decided to do something that night instead of kill him. I prayed to God. And for about 2 hours, I cussed God out because we had words. I didn't have much to say to God at the time besides profanity. You know, anything that you could think of that would be blasphemous or hatred, I said. And after about 2 hours, I realized there's nothing more negative I could possibly say. And I said, well, since I'm down here on my knees, you might as well help me stay sober for a while because I don't want to hate anymore. Alcohol always worked for me. Every time that I got drunk and it felt good. I can't even imagine the horror of knowing that the booze stops working, you know. That was my sponsor's bottom, and that sounds terrifying too, you know. I just didn't want to be afraid anymore. I didn't want to hate. So I prayed for God's help, and I woke up the next morning. And that same feeling that I got from that fifth step earlier, I felt relief, and I felt oneness with a creator, even though I still hated that creator, and I had no idea what that creator was. But I felt calm. And it was cool. 15 minutes later, something pissed me off. So I go in the bathroom, I say the serenity prayer, I come out, good. 15 minutes later, something pissed me off. Go in the bathroom and I say the serenity prayer and I'm good. For like the next 2 weeks, I just set a timer. Every 15 minutes, I went in the bathroom and I said the serenity prayer, because even if I wasn't pissed off during those 15 minutes, I knew that I was going to be soon. So I immediately got in the habit of prayer. And it was awkward. It was uncomfortable. I did not like it. It gave me momentary relief from alcoholism. And, you know, I made a decision that I'm going to try something else for a while. And if it doesn't work, drinking still works. So I got into prayer. And after I got kicked out of that rehab, I got kicked out of every rehab I went to, with the exception of the one I did a fifth step at, go figure. I get kicked out of this rehab, and I knew that there was no way that I would ever be able to be sober if I was homeless. And I had 26 days or something like that. They gave me the boot, and I'm in California. I was born in San Diego, but you know, I hadn't been to San Diego in 15 years or something like that, so I know nobody, and I'm homeless. And since I knew there was no way that I would possibly ever be able to stay sober through being homeless, I go try to find a drug dealer, you know, and give up, you know, 25 days or whatever it was of my sobriety. This doesn't happen often, but it does happen. I asked God to help me, you know, 2 weeks before, whatever it was, and I asked God for a new way of life. Every single drug dealer in Laguna Beach was out. How does that happen? You know? How does that happen? I got really, really lucky, you know, and I was given something called grace. Grace is a word that's thrown around a lot in Alcoholics Anonymous, but not a lot of people know what it means, you know. Grace is undeserved favor. It is undeserved reward. My life up until that point, I felt really did not deserve any grace. I hadn't done anything awesome with my life. I like to do graffiti, and I like to do crime. These are my pastimes, you know. God made sure I stayed sober that day. You know, which just confirms to me, God does for me what I cannot do for myself. And what I cannot do for myself is to maintain sobriety without a spiritual experience. I get a sponsor and I dive into these steps with the desperation of a dying man. Because I want a new way of life. And I'm angry, I'm furious. I have no solution yet because I haven't completed the 12 steps. The obsession of alcohol is not removed from me. But I have willingness and I have fear. I have more fear of drinking than I do of working steps. So I get a sponsor. And I start taking commitments. And I realize everything pisses me off. Everything sucks and everything pisses me off. But it was told to me very, very early on in sobriety. And, you know, for the last 10 or 15 minutes that I'm up here, how I stay sober may seem kind of harsh, you know. Some people, sponsors, may handle them with kids' gloves. Alcoholism is harsh. It kills all of us, you know, without thinking who we are, you know. So when I got sober, they told me, fuck your feelings. This is not your reality. What is your reality is your actions, you know. Get these steps, and I don't care what you feel, you know. I don't care how angry you are. I don't care how sad, how scared you are. Work these steps. Take commitments, you know. I believe faith is an action. I believe that it is a verb, which means that there must be action involved. So I start applying these spiritual principles that I know will not keep me sober into my life, you know. I worked the first step with my sponsor, honestly. I'm honest for the first time to myself that I am an alcoholic. You know, I like to hold on to this idea that I'm 18 years old, there's no way that I can be an alcoholic. I like to smoke my alcohol, there's no way that I can be an alcoholic. I can't relate with Bill Wilson, he's old and he plays golf. I can't be an alcoholic. But I showed brutal honesty in that first step with my alcoholism. There were still probably other lies about other areas of my life. But when it came to what I did and how I did it, I'm a drunk through and through. And, you know, I get to the second step and it confused the hell out of me, you know. Come to believe that a power greater than myself can restore me to sanity. I had issues with God. I hadn't had enough personal experience to know that God could keep me sober. And I'm looking at the second step, you know, and I'm lagging on it. And it's not because I don't want to do it. It's I don't know how to do it because I know that it's not going to work for me. God is not going to remove my obsession of alcoholism. You know, and my sponsor broke it down simply after I'd been stuck on it for like a month and a half. He's like, do you believe that I'm sober as a result of working the 12 steps? And I said, sometimes. And that was my start. You know, spiritual principle behind the second step is hope. And when I was ready to do the second step with my sponsor, I gave him a paragraph and it said, I don't believe that this shit's going to work for me. But I got my fingers crossed and here's hoping for the best. Even though I didn't know it, I nailed the second step perfectly. You know, because I believe that maybe not all of you are full of shit. Maybe some of you do stay sober if you finish the 12 steps. And if you're new or you're relatively new and you're struggling like I struggled in the beginning, if you feel that you're different, terminally unique, everyone in this room is, you know. And if you feel that you're different from the way that everyone else in this room is different, yeah, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. You're in the right place. I have a disease that does not want me to relate with anyone or anything about anything spiritual. I pick up that big book, even today, I've been sober 11 years and a month, something like that. I pick up that big book, and if I try to read it by myself, I fall asleep in 5 minutes. You know, I have a disease that wants me dead and wants nothing to do with spiritual growth. It wants me to live completely in ego. And, you know, like our birthday boy Matt shared, if you're new and you have no idea what's going on, thank God. Let someone else think for you for a while. Get a sponsor and jump into these steps. You don't have to believe that they're going to work for you, but know that they worked for me. And I didn't think they were going to work for me, you know. They worked for my sponsor. They worked for his sponsor. And they've worked for everyone in Alcoholics Anonymous that I've seen that has worked all 12 of them in order. The obsession of alcohol has been removed from them. That second step took me about 3 years of my sobriety to really understand. You know, another one of the spiritual principles behind it is reliance, reliance upon God, you know. And even though I had known at this point, because I had completed, you know, the 12 steps, and, you know, I'm taking everyone that I could possibly find to a meeting, you know, I'm doing H&I, I'm doing all these things. I still didn't think that God could do much else for me outside of removing the alcohol. And with 3 years, I hit another bottom, you know. A dam broke, and I realized that God is everything or God is nothing. You know, there's no choice in this anymore. I cannot tell you how many times a sponsee has called up, or I've said this myself in those first 3 years, on the phone, flipping out, girlfriend problems, I don't know what to do, you know, my girlfriend, blah, 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 you know, my life sucks, everything. It's like, well, have you prayed today? No? Don't you think you may want to give that a shot? Okay, I'm going to give that a shot. They call me back later. Well, how'd the prayer go? Oh, I didn't have to pray. My girlfriend called me back and, you know, we worked it out. Even in Alcoholics Anonymous, which is a spiritual program, there's not many of us that really have the desire for spirituality. You know, because alcoholism is a nemesis. It is a powerful foe. And it wants to do everything to keep me from spiritual growth. You know, and it took me 3 years to realize that reliance upon God is the only way that I'm going to be happy. You know, it's the only way to make this sober thing worthwhile. You know, like I said earlier, I religiously, you know, take part in the 11th step like 3 times a day. And, you know, which probably takes about 25 minutes to half an hour of my life. And while I'm doing that, I'm uncomfortable. My mind goes to 100 other places, you know. I can't focus my mind on anything. But what I get from, you know, that 25 minutes to a half an hour of, you know, seeking God consciousness used to take me about 15 hours of drinking. You know, and maybe if I was lucky, when my head hit the pillow that night, I get what I get after a half an hour of meditation, you know. AA works. AA really works. You know, some of the gifts that I've gotten in sobriety, the biggest gift I got, when I first got sober, my sponsor told me this: these are my priorities. God, meetings, family. Anything else is icing on the cake. And I try to keep things as simple as that today. And when I do, cool things start to happen. You know, one of them being the 9-step promises that we talk about. If you're new in this program and you haven't worked a 9-step yet and you think these promises have come true in your life, they haven't. I'm sorry. The 9-step promises come as a result of doing the 9-step. because we've cleared our side of the street. There's no reason to ever look over our shoulder again because we've made retribution, you know. I didn't know that at first, you know. I got a medical bill, I think, when I had like 3 months. And, you know, fear of financial insecurity will leave us. I was on like the third step at the time. And that ran through my head. And I'm like, oh, cool, I don't have to be afraid about this. Crumpled it up and I threw the bill away. That's what I thought freedom from fear of financial insecurity was. Because I hadn't worked a ninth step, you know. Up until that point, all the meetings I'd been taken to, they're reading these promises. And at the end it asks, are these extravagant promises? Hell yeah! To a using alcoholic or someone who has not had the obsession of alcohol removed from their lives, these are very extravagant promises. How am I going to know peace without drinking? You know, how? I can't even comprehend that. But I get some steps underneath my belt and I can start to understand peace, you know. The rest of the promises have come true as well. You know, some of the gifts of the program, like I said, the relationship that I have with God, when I first worked the third step, God as I understand Him, as I get back to that step later, God as God wants to be understood. My third step took on a profound meaning. And I was able to, you know, to dive into more spiritual aspects. You know, sobriety is not easy. Sobriety is not always fun. But regardless of the circumstance, I can have peace if I maintain a spiritual condition. I have a niece who is 3 now. And when she was 1, she got brain cancer. My sister is an alcoholic like the rest of us. She calls me and she says, hey, you know, cancer is terminal. Your niece is going into hospice. She'll probably be around for 2 weeks. It's one of the heaviest things I had to walk through. Especially, I got that call that my niece is going into hospice twice. You know, her battle with cancer has been up and down, up and down, up and down. Because I apply these spiritual, you know, principles to my life, I never once blamed God for this. God has nothing to do with this. But what I did do is realize that even through my sadness, even through my sister's sadness, even through my fear and anxiety of losing a niece and, you know, the terror that that is going to have on my sister and, you know, her husband, it's an opportunity to grow closer to God. When something good happens in my life. When I went swimming with manatees on New Year's. Opportunity to grow closer to God. You know, my spiritual practice is simply that, you know. Whatever is happening in life, it's neither good nor bad. And this is my belief. This is not AA's belief, but it's what brings me peace. It's neither good nor bad. It's simply an opportunity to grow closer to God. And it's my responsibility as a spiritual being, as a result of working these steps, to realize that and, you know, to develop that relationship even more. As a result of placing God first, meeting second, family third, I have a God in my life. I have meetings that I'm accountable to. I have 2 home groups, and I have a fellowship based around me that is going to keep me accountable even when I don't want to be accountable. You know, and my sponsor says this to me all the time. We sponsor each other. You know, I work the steps with him, but just because you're not my sponsor doesn't mean that you can't tell me that I'm lying and full of shit when I need to hear that. You know, this program is an amazing deal. I did not think sobriety would ever work for me. And, you know, 11 years later, I have freedom and happiness. And, you know, I have the ability to walk others through the steps. And if you're new or you're relatively new, it sucks, but you only have to be new once. And I promise you, if you don't drink and if you go to meetings and you get a sponsor and you work these steps, you'll never have to be new again. Thank you for letting me share. Thank you.